When Rabbi Posey first asked me to take the slot and spend some time learning together in preparation for the ending of the fast, I threw out the title dealing with courage, with fear, courage, and risk, not with any particular idea in mind, and certainly not with full awareness of the fact that at this time there would be so much fear and so much need for courage and so much concern about risk in our national consciousness. But I've got to tell you, just personally, I'm not afraid of Iran. And I don't feel fear. I have no doubt that what's going on is not good for us, and it's not good for the world. But that's not where my sense of fear resides. My sense of fear resides with a different group of people altogether, and they're much closer to home. My sense of fear resides with a large part of the community of secular liberals, whether Jewish or non-Jewish, whether the media or out of the media, who've abandoned a quest for truth and the discernment between truth and falsehood in favor of the pursuit of what they deem to be good and right for the world. And so we now have a large body of influential people who have strong views on what is good and what is right. And what is true and what is false is not so much of an issue. And we see that in the media. Whether Israel has a claim that is true doesn't get much media attention. Whether the Arabs are making claims that are abundantly false doesn't get much media attention. The attention is just what's good and what's bad. What's good in terms of liberalism? What's good in terms of democracy? What's good for the world at large? And that is completely obscured a focus on truth. And that concerns me much more, because if the world was focused on truth, Iran wouldn't have a chance. If the world was focused on truth, Israel would be safe. If the world was focused on truth, the Arab enemies of Israel and of the West wouldn't have a chance. The reason they can flourish is because the world has abandoned its focus on truth and its interest in truth in favor of goodness. And so there'll be two themes weaving through what we talk about today. The one, the issue of fear, courage, and risk. And the other is truth and falsehood versus good and bad. I'm also going to try and give some insight into three questions that have perplexed me, and I'm sure many of you, for many years. The one is, why are we still so intense in our commemoration of events of 2,000 years ago and more, so much more so than the events that happened so much more recently? There isn't a day in our Jewish calendar, there's a secular Yom HaZikaron, but there isn't a day such as Tisha B'Av to commemorate the Holocaust. And yes, we wrap it into Tisha B'Av, and this is our day of general mourning for national tragedy and catastrophe. But if you think of the intensity of a day like today, how far we go, and we've been focusing on it already for 3 weeks. This is just the culmination of 3 weeks of build-up for something enormous that happened 2,000 years ago. But it was 2,000 years ago. And it's never become any less in our, the pain and the intensity hasn't diminished in our national consciousness. Secondly, why even after we have the State of Israel, is there no diminishment of Tisha B'Av? We say the same things we've always said, we daven for the same things we've always davened, we cry about this. So there's no mention in our tefillot that things are a little better than they were 70 years ago. And for the previous 2,000 years, not even mentioned. It's irrelevant. And the third question is, what is the root cause of what we're mourning for? Because if we're meant to do anything about it, and the purpose of fasting and the purpose of focus is to try and do something about it. That's the reason for fasting. It's not a national day of mourning. The idea of fasting is to personalize it and to say, what can I do? In what way can I make a difference in rectifying the root cause of what went wrong with the destruction of two temples? So those are the three areas I want to look at as well. Why after 2,000 years is it still so powerful and overrides any other national tragedy? Why, even after we've got the State of Israel, does that make no difference at all to the way we celebrate Tisha B'Av? And what is the root cause of what we're mourning for, the destruction of the Beit HaMikdash? Now, I want to start off by asking, if you had pencil and paper, I would ask you to do it on pencil and paper, but without that, just try and do it in your mind. I would like you to identify 3 or 4 or 5 of the things you fear most. Just take a moment and think about the things and actually identify them, name them. If I were to say to you, what are your biggest fears? Identify them in your mind. What are your 3 or 4 or 5 biggest fears? Just take a moment to do that. And having done that, I would suggest that you might find, most of you in most cases, might find a pattern to what you fear. And the pattern would be that you fear losing some things you've got. So it could be fear of loss of life, fear of loss of loved ones, fear of loss of money, fear of loss of health. It's fear of losing something you've currently got. You might find, is there anybody who that pattern doesn't work with at all? The things you fear have nothing to do with loss at all. Usually I find what we fear are loss. In fact, I would go so far as to say as all we fear is loss. If we had nothing, we would fear nothing. We only fear losing what we've got. Which is interesting because what we've got is extrinsic to ourselves. It's not ourselves. And therefore, courage comes when we're able to detach a little bit from the things we've got and say, you know what? If I lose it, it's not what I want. Nobody likes losing anything. Even if I lose my car keys, it's irritating. Don't want to lose anything. But if I do, I'm still intact. I'm still me. If you think about how the survivors of the Holocaust, many of them, came out of that and rebuilt lives. It just defies any kind of imagination. Rebuilt lives so quickly, so engagedly, so enthusiastically, so vibrantly. Didn't just rebuild lives, they built empires, some of them. Rebuilt their families. Rebuilt their businesses. Started new businesses. Started communities. And one looks at that in awe and admiration and wonders, how would any of us have the wherewithal to do that? They came with nothing to this country and to other countries. They came with nothing, with very little connection, no language, no money, sometimes not even health, often no family, and were able to become vital and vibrant and one of the very many great contributions that the Museum of Tolerance makes, Liebe Geftes, here, wonderful to have you with us, is just allowing people to meet some of these survivors and talk with them. And who knows how long we'll still have that privilege. And here, then, people who do so always comment about their optimism and their vibrancy and their enthusiasm for life. Where does it come from? Because I would argue that the Holocaust was beyond, terrible beyond anything we can imagine. And people who went through it experienced horrors that defy anything we can conceive of. But what they lost, they considered to be extrinsic. They were still alive. Their Yiddishkeit was alive. Their belief in God in many cases was alive. Their belief in the Jewish people was alive. You've seen some of those YouTube clips of them singing Hatikva at the liberation of the concentration camps. We know their optimism. We know that they came out of that believing the Jewish people is still intact and they're still intact. And if you're intact, you can start again. If you're intact, you can rebuild. And if we can go into risky situations understanding, okay, you're going to invest some money in a risky enterprise, you might lose the money. If that's not okay for you, don't take the risk. it's got to be okay for you. You've got to be able to say, I don't want to lose. I'm going to try and make sure that I don't lose. But if I do, it's okay. There's an upside. I'm doing it for the upside. I'm doing it for something bigger. I'm willing to take a chance. I'm willing to risk. When a soldier goes into battle, the soldier is willing to risk his life. Willing to detach somewhat from, it's okay if I die, it's okay. It's not what I want to do. I'm going to try not to. I'm going to save everybody else's life if I can. But if I don't survive, I'm doing it for something bigger and for something more worthwhile. A soldier has to go into it with that mentality. That's how you take a risk, is when you understand that what you're risking is small compared to the reason you're doing it, to the reason you're risking it for. And that's where courage rests. So could we be courageous about what's going on in the world today and say, you know what, say Iran's got an atom bomb. If we lose Israel, say we lose it. It's happened before. That's not so easy. Why not? Because Eretz Yisrael is for us, it's not extrinsic. Eretz Yisrael is not something we possess. We're okay and we've got a land. Eretz Yisrael is intrinsic. And not just Eretz Yisrael, the country, Eretz Yisrael, the land. That's not what it was about. When we lost the Beis HaMikdash, what we lost was a connection with God. We lost a national connection with God. And yes, we can each establish some kind of connection, but it's difficult, it's hard. When the Beis HaMikdash was there, there was an ongoing connection. You could drive past the Beis HaMikdash and see the fires going, and see the sacrifices going, see the activity going. You could see God and the Jewish people interacting. You could see it visibly all the time. Miracles in front of your eyes all the time. We lived in miracle. That was Israel. And in a way, in a small way, that's still Israel. Israel is miracle. Not just the existence of Israel, but any of you who've spent some time there have experienced a level of coincidence that happens when you're there that it doesn't happen anywhere else in the world. Just a level of miracle. It's a miraculous existence. Our connection with God is much greater. But when we had Yerushalayim as it had to be, with the Beis HaMikdash as it had to be, and we lived that kind of life, we had a connection with God. What happened with the Churban Beis HaMikdash, the destruction of the temple, wasn't the loss of a building. It was the loss of a connection with God. That's intrinsic, that's not extrinsic. And what we fear is that little connection we've still got through Israel, where there's the study of Torah and the Jewish people together and people living with mitzvahs and lots of chesed and lots of tzedakah taking places and people willing to fight for what is Jewish and for what we stand for. That little connection we've still got through that little piece of land, to lose that, that's not about losing something extrinsic, and we would be okay without it. It's okay to risk. It's not okay. That's something we can't afford to risk. And so, what we commemorate on Tisha B'Av is not the loss of something extrinsic which we hope to recover. We mourn the loss of something intrinsic, a loss of identity. We're not the same Jewish people without the Beis HaMikdash as we were with the Beis HaMikdash. So it's a very different, as horrific as the Holocaust was, and other Jewish tragedies before that, they were all extrinsic. We didn't lose the essence of who we are. On the contrary, we saw after the Holocaust a new arising of who we are. We didn't lose the essence of who we are. But when we lost the Beis HaMikdash and we went off as slaves to Rome or to Babylon and wherever we went, that was the loss of who we were. That was the loss of our true identity. But let's go a little bit deeper into it and look at what is the source of this fear of loss. So if you look at these fears on your list, they're all fear of loss, you fear of losing something. What's also interesting, I find, when we ask people to do this exercise, is that in most cases people tell us that they've never actually experienced the things they fear. And those who have experienced say actually once they've experienced it, they fear it less. So a lot of the time we're carrying around fears of things that have never happened to us. They've happened to other people. We've experienced it vicariously, but we've never experienced it ourselves. So we're carrying around this fear, and the fear is incredibly paralyzing. If you think of your own life, and certainly the lives of others, and think, how many opportunities are missed because of fear? Fear of rejection, fear of denial, fear of risk, all the things that we fear, the phone call we fear to make, the approach we fear to make to another human being, the opportunity we fear to pursue, all because of what we might lose, what kind of risk is involved. If you put that all in a bag and you looked at how much opportunity we miss from not pursuing things because of fear. We realize how paralyzing that fear is. And it's a thought in our head. We fear things that haven't actually happened very often. But where does it happen that this fear is so intense? And I want to suggest that we have the pain of loss is so deeply embedded in our cellular memory that we just don't want to go there again. And the pain of loss that became embedded in the cellular memory of mankind was paradise lost. It was when Adam and Chava lost their place in Gan Eden. That is a pain we still feel. We've inherited that capacity. It's in our genes. As human beings, we know what it's like to be rejected. We know what it's like to be expelled. We know what it's like to lose our place. And that was a loss of identity. That wasn't anything extraneous. When Adam and Chava lose Gan Eden, they're not losing a home, they're not losing a place, they're not losing a community. They're becoming something completely different to what they were. What they were is no more. What they were and who they were is gone. That's the level of loss that they experienced when they were sent out of Gan Eden. And we know what that feels like. Deep in our cellular memory, we know what that feels like. And whenever we come near the feeling of loss, fear comes in. We know, well, we just don't want that pain anymore. That's the origin of fear, of the origin of loss. And it's quite interesting, when they were sent out of Gan Eden, when Adam and Chava were sent out of Gan Eden, where were they sent to? The Targum Yonason says they were sent to Har HaMoriah. What was Har HaMoriah? What happened there next? Akeda. Abraham is willing to risk his son, willing to lose even his son. He realizes that in the theme of the bigger issue of what he lives for, his son is extrinsic to him as well, not intrinsic. If he has to lose his son, if that's God's will, not what he wants, not what he desires, but so it is. And Yitzchak is willing to lose his life in terms of something higher. So there you get a bit of a recovery of the fear of loss through the courage to risk. Out of Gan Eden to Har HaMoriah, learn what it is to take risks. Yes, now you know what loss is, but you can't go through your life, you can't go through your national and universal life fearing loss all the time. You've got to be able to overcome that. And Har HaMoriah stands for courage. Har HaMoriah stands for the place where we have been willing to make sacrifice for something bigger, to make sacrifice for something greater, and to be courageous and overcome risk. But if we look at that expulsion from Gan Eden and how intrinsic it was, the sense of how intrinsic it was is in that powerful question that God puts to Adam right after the sin. And he says what? Ayeka, where are you? And Chazal said, well, God didn't know where he was. God didn't see him. That wasn't the question. The question is, you don't even know where you are anymore. You've lost yourself. Where are you? The you I created isn't there anymore. Where are you? And the Zohar says in that word, Ayeko, which is spelt the same as Eicho, Aleph, Yud, Chof, Hey, the Zohar says, Hacha Ramizle de Osid Lecharvo Beis Mikdosha. Here God hints to mankind that the Beis HaMikdash will not be able to be sustained. It will be destroyed. So where's the seed, that origin, the root cause of the destruction of the Beis HaMikdash that we commemorate today goes right back to the origin of mankind and to God's confrontation of Adam to say, Ayeka, you've lost yourself. And how did he lose himself? What did he do to lose himself? He ate from the Eitz HaDa'at Tov V'Ra. What is the Eitz HaDa'at Tov V'Ra? The Torah says it was an Eitz that was Nechmad HaEitz LaHaskil. Nechmad comes from the word Chemdo. Chemdo means desire. And that was the ability for desire, when desire could be infused into Seichel, into thought. Nechmad HaEitz LaHaskil. Normally something is Nechmad. It's Nechmad to eat. It's nechmad to look at. It's nechmad to touch. Nechmad lahaskil, what does that mean? It's desirous of thought. because after eating from the Eitz Hadat, Chemda and Seichel became intertwined. Now I can think not only about what is true and false, now I can think about what is nice and not nice, what I like and what I don't like, what my opinion is and what my opinion isn't. This was the beginning of secular liberalism. This was the time where objective truth no longer reigned. Until then there was Emet and Sheker. It was true and false, and the human beings strove to understand what was true. After Eitz Hadas, everybody has their own opinion. Who am I? Chemda is subjective. You like this, you like democracy, I like totalitarianism. That's okay. I'm Jewish, you're Muslim, that's okay. I think this is the right way to go, I think that, I think we should do a deal with Iran, you think we shouldn't do a deal with Iran. That's Tov Ha'etz, Nechmad Ha'etz La'Haskil. Everybody's got an opinion. So what should we do? Let's put all the opinions in a bag and we'll go by the majority opinion. Anything? Have we ever thought of anything so foolish? You can't do Emet like that. You can't discover Emet by putting everybody's opinion into a bag and taking the majority. That will tell you nothing about truth. It will just tell you about what most people desire. But there's such limitation to desire. What most people's opinion is. And one can say statistically there's some validity of most people's opinion, and maybe there's the wisdom of the crowds and all of that. But that all started with the Eitz Hadat. Until the time of the Eitz Hadat, there was only one method of discernment. Is it true? Is it false? If it's true, it's something I pursue. If it's false, it's something I avoid. And now all of a sudden, yes, there's truth and falsehood, but there's also another criterion of discernment which becomes Tov v'ra. Is it good? Is it bad? Do I think this is good for society or not? Well, that depends on your perspective. That depends on your background. That depends on your value system. Correct. So we all have different views as to what's good for society or not. So let's take a vote. But that's where we're at the moment. And if society were to think that it's good for society that Israel should not exist, and I ask you, is that reasonable to assume? That society should take the view that it's good for the world that Israel doesn't. It's just too much trouble. It's in the wrong place. It irritates the Muslim world. Just move it somewhere else. Move the Jews somewhere else. Just get rid of this Israel problem. It's not so difficult to think that the world might take the view that it's good for the world not to have an Israel. Is it true? No. But it's good. And if that's the majority opinion, that's what we're going to have to follow. And it's so interesting that very often when we see these challenges in the world and some of the difficulties and problems that we have in the world, very often they track down to our own people. And perhaps one of the most disturbing elements of this whole thing is the number of Jews that think that. The number of Jews today who think, not just on Iran, the number of Jews who think maybe it wouldn't be the end of the world if Israel were democratic, and if they're a majority of Arabs, and they're a majority of Arabs, you'll have certain agreements and it'll be established in a certain way and it'll be a normal democratic country. Because even as Jews we've become confused with the Eitz Hadat Tov V'ra, looking at what we think is good and what we think is bad, rather what is true and what is false. The difficulty with truth and falsehood is there almost always has to be a source of truth. There needs to be a belief, there needs to be a faith. And that's why I say the problem is secular liberalism, not liberalism. But secularism, where there's no source of faith, there's no source of objective truth, all you're left with is Tov V'ra. There is no Emet V'Sheker. There's my own truth. I can be true to myself, but being true to myself just means an opinion. It doesn't mean anything about truth. Hitler was true to himself all the way through. He did what he believed was right. He wrote in Mein Kampf exactly what he planned to do. He published it. He carried it out. He was completely true to himself. He did what he thought was in the good of mankind. He thought it was a good thing to do to wipe out the Jews. Certainly good for Germany. He did what was good. He was a democrat. He was a secular liberal. That's what he believed was good. And the majority of Germans put him into power. That's where you can go with secular liberalism. There's nothing to stop anything. Unless there's some body of objective truth where you can say, Tov V'ra we can debate. Tov V'ra we can disagree on. So right, each one of us has a different angle and a different perspective. But what is the MS? What is the truth? Is there anywhere we can go to find the truth? And there used to be a place we could go to the Beis HaMikdash and find the truth. We could go to the Kohen Godol and the Urim V'Tumim and we could find the truth. We could consult the Torah without political lenses and we could find the truth. But today that's not necessarily where we're that interested in going to. And we see this idea being taken further into the parasha that we read yesterday, where once again we see the word Eichel, the only times that word appears in the Torah itself, in the Chumash. First is the form of Ayeka, where Hashem forewarns us of the impending destruction of the Beis HaMikdash, of the temple, in his challenge to Adam of, where are you? You're lost. And then we have it again in yesterday's parasha in Devarim, where Moshe says, how can I? And here Echo is not where are you, here Echo is how can I bear your troubles and your burdensomeness and your arguments. And if you learn Rashi and understand what is Moshe complaining about, he says, what is Torchachem? Melamed Shayu Yisrael Tarchanim. The Jews were troublesome. What does troublesome mean? And Rashi gives a very specific angle on the troublesomeness that Moshe felt he couldn't handle on his own. And he says, Aya echad meim roet bal dino notzeach bedin. They would come to court. Moshe would be sitting on the bench. And one man would put his case and the other would argue the other side. And if one of them saw the other was winning, Omer yeshli edim labi, he would say, I've got some more witnesses to bring. Yeshli rayot lavi, I've got some more evidence to bring. Mosif ani alechem dayanim, I think we should have some extra judges here. This is a bigger case than we thought. I want three judges, not one. I want five judges, not three. Anything to delay and to manipulate the system so as to come out with a victory. Says Moshe, you're not interested in truth. You're interested in what's good for you. And if you're interested in what's good for you, we'll never finish the case. You'll manipulate the bureaucratic system until you get what you want or until you've exhausted every opportunity. I can't do that as a single judge. If you want to know the truth, that's quick. You can come to me. I have access to God. There's an Urim V'Tumim. There's Ruach HaKodesh. I've got my own intuition. If you want to know what's true and what's false, who's right and who's wrong in this argument, I can tell you. It'll take a minute. But if you want to know what's good for you, each of you is going to have a different perspective. And you're going to fight about what's good for each of you until the end. And that no particular man can necessarily handle on his own. And Masachem, Melamed Shayu Apikursim. On Masachem says Rashi, they were Apikursim, which normally means that they were atheists, agnostics. What does that mean here? Hikdim Moshe Latzet, Amru Mara Ben Amram Latzet. If Moshe came to his office early in the morning, they would say, why is he so early today? Shema eno shafui betoch beto, probably having an argument with his wife, so he decided to leave home early. Ichel latzeit, if he came late, amru mara ben amram shelo latzeit. Ma'atem svurim yoshiv yoetz aleichem etzot. They would say, why is he so late? What's he delaying for? Clearly he's busy plotting and scheming. They would attribute the worst motives to Moshe. Why? Why would they do that? No interest in truth. What is gossip? Gossip is to interpret an event in a way that makes you look good and the other person look bad. Very often when we make somebody else look bad, we feel good. That's what gossip does. It makes us feel good because look how bad everybody else is. Gossip's no attempt to find the truth. There's no interest in the truth. It's so interesting. I was learning the Chofetz Chaim recently. So the Chofetz Chaim wrote many, many, many works. Some more famous than others. So there's two very famous works. There's the Mishnah Berurah, which is the Sefer Halacha, which is the foundational book that everybody uses today. And he wrote the Chofetz Chaim also. He wrote the Shmiras HaLoshon, a book on the laws of Lashon Hara. And they're very intricate. How not to speak, when you can speak, how to hear, how not to hear, how to listen, how not to listen. And I was thinking as I was working through it, that book needs to be rewritten for the internet. Because 5 minutes can't go past on the internet, especially if you're on Facebook or one of the social media platforms, without transgressing serious Isurim of Lashon Hara. It's not possible. It's gossip and it's conjecture and it's opinions. It's no search for, not there are people who are, but there's a fortune of it that has no interest in a search for truth. And if you think how much of our lives today are really involved in a search for truth, that used to be something people regarded as terribly important, a search for truth. People would study philosophy in search of the truth. People would study sciences in search of the truth. What happens if a scientist now in one of the academic institutions were to say, I believe the truth is that evolution is wrong and creationism is right? You'd be run off the campus. It's not a search for truth. It's a search for what is good, for what is in vogue, for what is right for the times. The real search for truth, that we're not that involved. How much of our time, how much of our reading, how much of our media watching, how much of our thinking is about a true quest for truth. When we learn a piece of Chumash, or we learn a piece of Gemara, or we learn a piece of Rashi, how much of it is, I want to get to the truth of this. What is the truth? What is the soul of this thing that I'm studying? How much of our time is in that? Because we've all become very embodied in what feels good, what sounds right, what sits comfortably. You hear people saying, this sits comfortably with me, or this doesn't sit comfortably. Who cares if it sits comfortably with you? What's that relevant? It's such an irrelevant comment. Is it true or is it false? And do you have the tools to try and work that out? Do you have a way of trying to discern? This resonates with me. Who cares if it resonates with you? Perhaps if it didn't resonate with you, it would be more true. Because what resonates with you is only things that already sit comfortably with you, that exist in your relatively small world. When we encounter something that doesn't resonate, that makes us rethink, that makes us question our assumptions, maybe there's more truth in that. But we find comfort in what resonates, we find comfort in what sits with us. And we've abandoned, together with this whole drive of secular liberalism, and I'm just calling it that, that's probably not such a good name for it, there are probably many others who are involved in it as well, just the abandonment of a quest for truth in favor of a search for that which is good and comfortable and fitting, rather than that which is true. And so my fear for the future is, and it'll be interesting, we'll have time after this to have a bit of a discussion and to hear some of your views. I'll be really, really interested. My view is Iran isn't our enemy. I think the war we're going to have to fight, it's a terrible thing to say. I think there are two things about the war we're going to have to fight. And I put this out, even if it's uncomfortable and even if it doesn't resonate. I put it out. Tell me if you think it's true or not. Number one, it's a war of ideas. The issue is not about atom bombs. We're fighting a war of ideas. And we're losing the war of ideas. That's what we're busy worrying about, the atom bomb. That's a worry. But the war of ideas that's being fought is a much more serious war, and that could lose us Israel without an atom bomb, just by pressure. You see what's happening with the BDS movement. Scary how quickly and what kind of dynamic it has. That's an idea, and we're losing in the war of ideas. So my first thought is the real battle of the future is going to be a war of ideas. What's going to bring Mashiach, I don't know whether that's going to be Gog or Magog or not, but what's going to bring Mashiach is winning a war of ideas, not winning a war of territory. And secondly, one of my big fears, perhaps the biggest, is it's going to be a civil war. We're going to have to fight this war inside the Jewish people, because we're not on the same page. And as long as we're not on the same page, there's no chance that we can win external enemies. We don't have a common view. We're not all willing to fight. There are too many Jews who are not willing to fight the war of ideas, never mind to go and fight with one's life. But even to fight the war of ideas. How many of us will be willing to stand up and say something unpopular and write something unpopular and argue a position which is unpopular because we believe it's true? The pressure to be politically correct is so big that it bullies us into some form of submission. Political correctness is tov v'ra. It's good to be politically correct. It's good not to shake things up too much. It's tov v'ra. It's not emet v'sheker. Political correctness is the submission of truth in the service of goodness. Be good. Don't be true. Be good. Don't offend somebody. Be good. Be a good person. And our pursuit of being good and being seen to be good overrides our need to be truthful. Truthful with ourselves and truthful with one another and truthful with our society. So that's my biggest fear at this time. The fear that we have to fight a battle of ideas, not just a battle of territory. And more importantly, that we might have to fight internally, we might have to fight among ourselves to get ourselves on one page, that we can agree what we're willing to fight for, what's true and what's false, and that we can take, as a larger Jewish nation, that we can take that stance and progress those interests. And so if we go back to those questions at the beginning, why we still commemorate something of 2,000 years ago and things that were more recent, we don't. Because we're commemorating the loss of our identity. Without that access to truth that we have with the Beit HaMikdash, we're not the same people. God is still saying to us, Ayeko, where are you? Eicha, how can this happen? Where have you got to? What are you doing? Who are you? Where's your Jewish soul? And as proud as he is and as we are of all the wonderful things that we do as a Jewish nation, and we do the most wonderful things, but that connection with our identity, that willingness to fight for what is true, that Abrahamic principle, willing to be politically incorrect, that's Avraham. Avraham was not the first person to believe in God. Noah spoke to God. Why is he not the first Jew? Adam spoke to God. Why is he not the first Jew? Because when they spoke to God, it was politically correct to speak to God. Avraham was the first person to resist political correctness in favor of truth. That makes him Jewish. And that's why God asks us today, Ayeko, where are you, my Abrahamic people? Where are you, my Jewish people? Where is your commitment to truth? Why are you so politically correct when the world is so full of lies? Why aren't you standing up for that which is truth? Not only on the matter of Israel, on all matters. Why are you governed more by what is good than by what is true? And that's why we keep Tisha B'Av, because we're still there. We're still in that state of Churban. We're still without the Beis HaMikdash. We're still with loss of identity. And even though we have Eretz Israel, yes, we have Eretz Israel, but as I mentioned in Shul yesterday, when the Haftarah ends and the Navi tells us how things will be one day when things are restored to what they need to be, and that's part, we say that in the Shemona Esra 3 times a day, and I will return your judges to what they used to be in the beginning, people who judged by truth, not by political correctness and not by politics and not by expedience, people who judged by truth. And like your original advisors, when you went to an advisor, when you went to the Rav, or you went to the Kohen Gadol, or you went to the Melech, to the king, you got truth from them. You didn't get some kind of adulterated, ameliorated message of correctness. And I'll return you to that stage. Acharecha. After we've got people of truth leading our nation, and we are led by people who have the courage to risk that which is true, willing to lose everything except their essence. That's the only thing they're not willing to lose. That's courage. That's heroism. I'm willing to risk everything except who I am. I'm willing to risk everything I have. Even in Avraham's terminology, even my family. I'll risk everything. But not the essence of being Jewish. That I won't risk. Not my commitment to truth. That I won't risk. I'll die for that. And then, when our leaders are like that, then Yerushalayim will be called the city of justice. Kirya Ne'emana, a faithful city, a faithful town, a faithful place to live. And that's why we still keep Tisha B'Av, even though we've got Israel. We've got Israel, but we don't yet have an Ir HaTzedek. We don't have even one city in Israel that is governed only by truth. No politics, just truth. We don't even have a city. We probably don't even have a neighborhood in Israel yet that is governed only by what's true. not by any kind of political consideration, not whether it's good and bad, tov v'ra, but emet v'sheker. And so we still have to persist to get there, to achieve that, to move towards that. And what is the root cause that we can do something about? The root cause was our loss of a passion for truth. And each of us can do something to recover that in our own way. Firstly, in our own life and with our own families, to keep on checking in. Not what is good and what is bad. And just the conversation is an interesting one. Just to stop yourself and say, are we talking about good or bad, or are we talking about true and false? Let's first decide what this conversation is about. If it's about good and bad, then let's hear everybody's opinion, because they matter. If it's about true and false, not interested in everybody's opinion, because it doesn't matter. Let's just find out what's true. Let's go to the Torah and find out what's true. That's all that matters. And if just that conversation alone starts bringing us back to our identity, you're having a debate with somebody, you're having a conversation with somebody, just unpack it. Are we talking about good and bad? Are we talking about opinions? Are we talking about correctness? Or are we talking about truth? If it's truth, the Torah is our source, so that we can recover something of who we are and what we are, so that when Hashem says, Ayeko, we can say, right here, God, ready. And Eicha is no longer a question of how can we manage and how did this happen, but Eicha is simply a question of how do we get back to where we were and become the nation that is the guiding light of truth to the nations of the world, one nation at least whose leadership and whose decisions are taken on the basis of truth, not expedience, on the basis of truth and not politics. So in the time that we have, and we have a few minutes still, I would be very interested to...